Welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Connie Kasser, your host for today's episode, and today we're going to be talking with Wendy Hassenkamp and Jana White. They're the co-editors of The Monastery and the Microscope, Conversations with the Dalai Lama on Mind, Mindfulness, and the Nature of Reality. This book was published by Yale University Press and was recently named by Tricycle Magazine as one of the top Buddhist books of 2017. Wendy and Jana, welcome to the show.
Hi, Connie.
Hi. So I'd like to start off, as we normally do in our New Books podcast, by asking you to talk a bit about yourselves. If you could just tell us where you're from, your educational background, and how you wound up in fields related to Buddhist studies. So, Wendy, let's start with you.
Sure, yeah. I am from New Jersey originally, and I did my undergraduate at Wake Forest in North Carolina. And then I went on to do a PhD at Emory University in Atlanta, where you and I met first. And I did my PhD in neuroscience. So my background is originally pretty far from Buddhist studies. I studied schizophrenia for many years and psychosis, but I was always really interested in mind. And then I actually came around to the Buddhist world from a personal interest in meditation. And then I slowly kind of started shifting my career towards studying meditation from the neuroscience perspective. So that put me in touch with a lot of Buddhist studies folks. And that's kind of where our paths crossed down at Emory. And since then, I now work for the Mind and Life Institute, which is a big part of this book and the event that this book covers. So maybe we can talk more about that later.
Okay, great. And Jana, how about you?
I am from Vermont originally, and I got my BA from Smith College, same place as Connie, and I actually studied religion and math there, and I just recently was talking to my math advisor from my days at Smith and saying how amazing it is to me that when I left Smith, I could not possibly imagine how my professional career could continue to uphold anything that would allow me to do those two things at once. And yet somehow this book and my work has brought me back to that intersection. So that's been really exciting for me. I started out in the world of communications and then moved into working as an editor and have specialized as an editor in works in Buddhist studies. So I'm a freelancer and I work with different publishers as well as directly with authors and organizations. And I also do work in academic administration. So.
Yeah, I love that I went to school with each of you at very different times in very different places and that we're all working in Buddhist studies in different capacities. And we all lived for a period of a few years at the same time in Northampton, where Jana, you still are.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, how did this book come about and how did the two of you end up working on this book together?
Maybe I can jump in for the beginning. I can give a little background about the event that this book covers and a little bit about the Mind and Life Institute. Maybe that would help set the stage.
Yeah.
The Mind and Life Institute is a nonprofit that does a lot of work between meditation and Buddhist philosophy and science. And so there's been a longstanding dialogue now for the last 30 years that Mind and Life has been involved in helping to encourage and promote between Buddhism and science, particularly as this book covers Tibetan Buddhism and Western science, if we want to be more specific. But part of that, actually the Mind and Life Institute itself emerged from the Dalai Lama and his interest in science, and then a number of scientists who were also interested in mind and particularly some perspectives that Buddhist philosophy has on mind. And so they started hosting these intimate week-long conversations between the Dalai Lama and some leading cognitive scientists and philosophers. And that has continued, and the Mind and Life Institute has blossomed to also do other things like fund research in this area and hold conferences with academics who are working in this area. But we still continue to hold these dialogues with the Dalai Lama as part of our core work. So this event was a particularly interesting one of those dialogues that took place in 2013. And historically, these dialogues had been held in the living room, basically, of the Dalai Lama. So in a really intimate setting, maybe just 100 or fewer people there watching in the audience. But in this particular case, the Dalai Lama really wanted to have it in a much larger setting to expose the conversation to a larger audience of Tibetan monastic students. So in South India, there are a number of large monastic universities. And His Holiness had also been working for many years, also through some work with Emory University, as it happens, to build a program that would help teach science to these Tibetan monastic students. And science wasn't a normal part of their curriculum. And the Dalai Lama had begun to see how important and how much overlap there was with Buddhist philosophy. So I had actually been a little bit involved in some of that work. But then when I went to work for the Mind and Life Institute, one of the first things that that I did there was to help plan this conference. So it was basically a dialogue between the Dalai Lama and a number of scientists and philosophers, but in this larger setting with many thousands of monastic students there to kind of witness how this conversation can happen. So maybe that's a good background. And Jana, I don't know if you want to jump in and say how you got involved.
Sure. Well, I got involved with the Mind and Life Institute because I was working full-time as a freelance editor, and I met in a social context, actually, somebody who worked for Mind and Life at that time, who had another book project based on another Mind and Life dialogue that later turned into the book Caring Economics that was edited by Mathieu Ricard and Tanya Singer. And the book was, at that point, was pretty far along in its process, but it needed some cleaning up. And so I met somebody at Mind and Life and was brought on to sort of do the wrapping up of that project. And then I think it was right around that time that the conference had taken place that our book is based on. And there was some energy around wanting to turn it into a book, but recognizing that it would be useful to have some help and to try to figure out how that would happen from turning the raw material of the conference into a book. And so Wendy and I started talking, and 4 years later, here we are.
So were these conversations with the Dalai Lama, this particular set of conversations, were they carried out with the intention of making it into a book? I mean, did people know that going into these conversations that it would eventually be written down and published?
I think that when we were planning the meeting, there was kind of a loose idea that we may turn it into a book, but we weren't clear when the meeting was actually happening, what the specific outcome would be. But it wouldn't be too surprising for those participants, because many of the dialogues historically had been turned into books. So I think it was kind of always on the table, but there wasn't a clear plan until a few months afterwards, actually, when we started connecting with Jana and putting together the real plans.
Jana, you kind of alluded to this, but one of the things that I really love about this book is that it's easy to read. Not necessarily in terms of the subject matter, because there's a lot of hard stuff that's being talked about in the book. But in terms of the prose, it really does read like a series of conversations. And when I'm reading it, one of the things that I really like is that it makes me feel like I'm there in the room with these people. But I'm also aware, because I saw you guys working on this in Northampton, I'm aware of the many hours that the two of you spent working on this project, listening to audio recordings and transcribing them and editing them and making them readable. So I'm wondering, and Jana, maybe we can just start with you since you kind of mentioned this process. What would you say was the most difficult aspect of taking these recorded conversations and turning them into readable prose?
Well, that is the question, right? I mean, it's I think the temptation is to say, well, oh, we have these transcripts, and then we sort of added some titles and headings, and then that became our book. And while at a very basic level, that's true, there's barely, you know, a sentence or two in here that we didn't touch in some way. And I think the real work was to try to figure out how can we turn this into something that preserves that character that you're talking about, that I'm so glad that comes across in the book to preserve that conversational tone and that sense of that you're really there live and experiencing conversations in the way that they happen, which is to say that they're not perfect and sometimes people trail off and sometimes an idea isn't fully realized and they have a spontaneity to them. And we really wanted to preserve that character while at the same time recognizing that if we just left everything untouched, nobody would want to read it and nobody would really be able to make sense of it. And so I think the real challenge for us was to try to figure out how can we intervene strategically to keep that character without without dulling down the that spontaneity and also preserving all of the unique voices. You know, we have almost 20 different contributors who speak at various points in the book. And then also, you know, Wendy and I made our contributions through footnotes and some commentary throughout to clarify. And so trying to balance as well all of the different voices that are there and make sure that their points come across, but also that they retain their unique character and personality. And so that's a very subtle, it's very subtle work, very difficult work. But I'm really glad that you and hopefully others feel like we've achieved it. And I think that's why we took as long as we did to do it, because I think that's really what makes the book so special, is that it makes it feel like even though there were a lot of people at the event, more people at this event than at a traditional dialogue, you know, there were thousands of people there, but now anybody in the world can be a part of that. And I think that's a really special thing.
Yeah, it's really amazing. It's really special. And yeah, I can't imagine the work that went into this, because you know, you're right. People don't speak in complete sentences, you know? So it's almost like an act of translation, you know, translating something from spoken conversation to the written word printed on a page. Wendy, I'm wondering if you have anything you maybe want to add to that. Was there anything particular that you found that was particularly difficult in this process?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Jana described, and she's so skillful with this. She really took the major burden of the raw transcripts into a digestible form for each chapter, and then she and I started working back and forth. So I think she did the larger part of that raw editing, which she's so skillful at, and I really appreciate it because it is so much work. It's a particular kind of art. But yeah, after she took the first pass, then we started working back and forth quite a bit and like really fine tuning each chapter, and eventually got it to the point where we would then go back to the original contributor as well and make sure that they were, okay with all of it. So I think I'm trying to think of your question of like the most difficult part. It might've been just deciding what pieces of the conversation, you know, were most important and what pieces maybe should be removed to clarify things, or, you know, making those cuts sometimes was difficult as Jana was saying, in the overall effort of trying to retain the character and voice of the speakers, as well as the most important information that was being portrayed. And, you know, at times when people trail off or the conversation just veers off in a totally different direction, how to manage that and try to keep things focused for the reader. So, but I think it ended up being a really fun process. It did, you know, I learned a lot about editing, especially from Jana too. So I'm glad to hear also that it comes across, you know, that it reads cleanly and as if it's, you're right there in the conversation. That's what we were hoping for.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does. I mean, that's, I think one of the most special things, about this book. And so there are a lot of people involved in the book. I think something like 18 contributors and then the two of you. And so, I mean, obviously the main contributions from these other contributors, I mean, you have people who are well known in neuroscience, you have people who are well known in Tibetan Buddhism. And obviously their main contributions to this volume involved their actual conversations back and forth with the Dalai Lama. And Wendy, you mentioned kind of sending drafts of things to them to give their okay. I mean, what was the involvement of other the other contributors involved in this book? Was it mostly that they were just kind of giving their okay on the conversations, or were there any people who were more actively involved?
Yeah, I think Jana can probably
add
to that. Yeah.
As Wendy mentioned, you know, we did the bulk of the heavy lifting in terms of deciding what to keep, what to cut, in some cases to reorganize things, as well as what order the presentations would appear in the book. And so we did all of that work, and then we contacted the contributors again and said, okay, here's what we have, and we really want your feedback. And it, in some cases, you know, people wrote back and basically said, this looks fine. And some people would make light edits or help fine-tune graphics or add new citations. You know, that happens sometimes where the conference took place in 2013. And so somebody would say at the moment, you know, we're working on research right now that we think is going to show XYZ. But then by the time we were actually finalizing the book, that research was farther along and in some cases had been published. And we wanted to be able to include that as much as we could. And so we also worked with people to bring everything up to date to the extent that that was possible. And to just make sure that we'd, represented their points correctly. And in some cases, of course, I mean, Wendy and I each are bringing our own expertise, but the bulk of the book represents material that she and I are not subject experts in. And so we really wanted to make sure that we were capturing the nuance as best we could. And so that was really important to make sure that we weren't kind of getting things wrong. And so each of the contributors helped to make sure that just the real meat of the argument was correct. And then, so we invited as much feedback as people wanted to provide. And it was great to be able to bring people back in at the tail end of that process and sort of get their insight and their blessing. And then we move forward into, you know, the editorial process with Yale. But at that point, people were fine to just let us do that last fine tuning ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's really, so, I mean, there are so many voices at play in this work, and that's one of the things that makes it so interesting to read. So that's great.
One thing we haven't really touched on yet that I think was also a big piece of the preliminary work that Wendy and I did is that the order in which the presentations and material appears in the book is not the order necessarily in which it happened at the conference.
Oh, okay.
And so that was one of our really big tasks at the beginning was to figure out, you know, we have hundreds of pages of raw material. What do we keep? What do we fix? What do we reorder internally, you know, within one speaker's section, but also what's the most sensible or compelling way to organize this material as a printed book? And I think actually that really surprised me. You know, I wasn't, and maybe Wendy can speak toward this a little bit. I wasn't involved in planning the conference and the order in which the conference took place. But obviously there was a lot of effort and thought that was put into that to try to figure out what's going to make this most compelling as a conference. But it's sort of amazing that the at order didn't actually end up translating into the right order for the book. And so, which we realized when we sort of read everything cover to cover of the raw transcripts. And eventually it became clear that we needed to sort of do some reorganization to make it tell a narrative story as a whole. And so that was really surprising and cool to me, actually, that it in a different medium, that we needed a different order to tell the story. So that was a big part of our work as well, just that big picture organization in addition to the, you know, the minute sentence by sentence, page by page, how is this all flowing, but how does it fit into a whole?
Yeah, that's a whole other level of thinking about these conversations and thinking about what's going on. So you guys were really working at multiple levels here. So that's I actually have a question about that, about the organization of the book in general, and maybe Wendy, you could speak to this a little bit. So the book consists of 15 chapters divided into two parts. The first part is titled Matter and Mind, and the second part is titled Transformation. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in each of those sections and why you guys chose to break up the book in that way?
Yeah, sure. I agree. Just like Jenna said, this was an interesting part of the process to step back from all of this content. I think we had over 600 pages of raw transcript. And I remember sitting in the coffee shop with our stacks of paper and trying to strategize what made the most sense. But that was a cool process because I started to get a different idea about almost this bird's eye view of the field and the conversation between science and Buddhism and how it's unfolded in these different ways. And so I think what became clearer to us and the way we ended up organizing the book is that there are really these two threads, as I see it, in the way that the dialogue between science and Buddhism has unfolded. And one of those threads is about kind of big picture nature of reality questions about what is this world that we live in and what is this stuff that we call mind and how do we relate to it? And it's almost like a parallel track. So that section of the book covers discussions on physics, particularly modern physics or quantum physics. And that's kind of the pieces that we think about the nature of reality and like the matter that is around us and this world we find ourselves living in. So Buddhism has ideas about that and science has ideas about that. And so that's a conversation. And then kind of in a similar way, we can think about mind as a particular subset of this world that we live in, right? So a little bit in a narrowing down to the focus, but the idea of consciousness, and of course, Buddhism has lots to say about that. And modern science is kind of just getting in that space where it has its own views from, you know, neuroscience or other kinds of theoretical perspectives. So ideas about these conversations seem to me to kind of run in parallel between the scientific tradition and the Buddhist tradition, in that it's not necessarily, of course, there's a dialectic back and forth, but one side isn't necessarily changing because of the other side. It's more of a conversation of understanding the different perspectives and where do they align and where do they diverge and what can we learn from that? But both traditions have had their own history of inquiry in these types of questions. So that's kind of the nature of mind and the nature of reality. And then the second half of the book felt like it had a really different quality because that's focused more on investigations within neuroscience, specifically neuroscience about meditation and how that may be affecting our brains and bodies and health and experience, and as well as then the application of meditation as it's happening now in Western society in so many different sectors. And so both of those conversations are really ones that it seemed to me that the conversation with Buddhism has really changed the way that science is asking, like the kinds of questions that science is asking, and then the way that they're even asking the questions. So that felt different because it was really the way that Buddhism is influencing these Western traditions. So there was a bit of a different flavor, I think. And that's focused more on transformation. We called it transformations because it's about how can we change our minds, brains, bodies? How can we change society through the practices that have been taken up now in the West coming out of the Buddhist tradition? So that's kind of how we ended up viewing it, which was a really great process to go through because it was something new to me to be able to step back and look at this, the whole field as it's evolving and understand these different angles of the conversation.
I just was going to say, it also creates a sort of a really nice flow in the book from, you know, as big picture gets, as Wendy said, sort of what is the nature of reality, the stuff of the world, the stuff of the universe. So it's this huge, huge question. And then sort of then getting a little bit closer into consciousness and then into mind and then into practices that we as individual people can be undertaking. And so we really liked that as a flow of the material to sort of start so big and then get down into something that any person who picked up the book or who's undertaking these practices or research or just showing an interest in this area can actually be doing something with in their life. So I think that was one of the things that we really liked about this, using that as the structure for the book.
Yeah. I mean, these are huge, big picture questions, you know, like what is reality? Why are we here? How do we perceive the things that we perceive? How do we know the things that we know? I mean, these are such huge questions. And so that's one of the things that's really exciting about this book is being able to see these very different perspectives. I mean, people coming from very different, you know, you guys talk about it in the introduction, these different modes of inquiry, you know, the modes of inquiry from a Buddhist philosophical perspective and modes of inquiry from a Western scientific perspective. So with that in mind, I'm just kind of curious, as you were listening to these conversations and editing this and thinking through how to organize this, did you guys find any conversations that seemed like they were particularly difficult, either because of the terminology used and difficulties with translation, you know, sometimes translating between Tibetan and English, or because of differences in terms of these different modes of inquiry and these vastly different backgrounds between Tibetan philosophy and Western science?
I can say a few things, I think, and Jana, you might have ideas too. I think around terminology, there are a number of areas where that can kind of come into conflict in this particular dialogue. A big one is around consciousness, the word consciousness. I think that Buddhism and science can have slightly different views about exactly what that means. For example, from the science perspective, it often means awareness that is reportable. So like from the science perspective, it's a subset of what Buddhism would view as consciousness. So like in science, it would be if you're conscious, if you're aware and awake and able to report on your experience. But as far
report
as I understand
meaning,
it.
Meaning like you can talk about it and describe it. Is that what you mean?
Yep. Yeah. Okay. You could give some sort of verbal report or perspective on subjective experience of your consciousness or something. So, and I think that's sometimes that leads to confusion in conversation, with Buddhists or Buddhist philosophers, because there, as I understand it, there's a much broader, lens on consciousness from that tradition. So sometimes within the conversation, you kind of have to take a sidebar and make sure that we really be clear about defining your terms, you know, from the different sides. And I think that's important for any interdisciplinary dialogue, because you're always going to hit up against people with very specific terminology, and then there can be misunderstanding, and then you can be off on the wrong path from the start. So that's one example that comes to mind that came up, I think, a number of times at the meeting while we were there.
Jana, was there anything you...
Wendy, I wonder if you could... Yeah, I wonder if Wendy wants to talk a little bit about actually the sort of preparations for these conferences that happens, because I think one benefit that we had of using the transcripts from the conference is that all of the presenters did really careful work to, from the start, make their argument in such a way that it would be understandable, at least in the broad brushstrokes, to somebody who was not a specialist in that area. Because if you think about all the different disciplines that the contributors to the book represent, as well as to the audience members who are there present at the event, they're not going to know the specific vocabulary from every single discipline and every single research area that this represents. And so a lot of careful work went in from the get-go to try to frame the arguments in a way that could be understandable. And Wendy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there are actually some almost kind of rehearsals that happen to make sure that that is achieved once the actual event takes place.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I do think that we benefited from all that preparation when we were working on the book, because there was kind of already this point of connection that we'd worked to achieve. So whenever we do these dialogues with the Dalai Lama, the Mind and Life Institute, once we've chosen the, you know, the speakers and the topic and all these kinds of things, we work really closely for, you know, many months prior to the event itself with the presenters, both in terms of the content that they're going to present and even the slides that they use and the way that they present, because this is a very unusual audience for, academic scientists and philosophers. Usually you're presenting to experts within your own field, so you can kind of skip over a lot of background and use really heavy jargon and everyone knows what you're talking about. But in this case, you're really speaking across quite a divide, different traditions. And, from the perspective of the sciences, the Buddhist monastics, of course, the Dalai Lama himself now has some background in science from these many years of his own study and interest. But this particular event, we were really also focusing on these monastic students who really had many of whom had no exposure whatsoever to the concepts of Western science, which is strange even for us to think about from our culture, because it's something that we're exposed to from young childhood, just basics of data and graphs and how you ask questions. And this was all new to those monastic students. So we really had to think carefully about how we were going to be able to present this data in a way that was accessible to them. And so we go through, we actually meet with the faculty and the presenters a couple months before, and we do, as Jana said, a kind of rehearsal dry run, and people give their presentations to us. And those of us who've, done this a number of times and are familiar, we work with them and edit their slides. And oftentimes people are getting too detailed and we need to kind of step back and give a bigger picture type of thing. So we do a lot of that work, and we certainly did for this meeting as well. And I think it paid off in terms of how accessible the material ended up being in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think the background of all of this, all the background work that you don't see, or that we as readers don't see, picking up this volume and just reading through it, it's noticeable. And as you guys mentioned, there's a lot that we, and by we, I mean, people who are from North America, who were educated in North American school systems, there's a lot that we take for granted, that people who are, monks educated in a Tibetan monastic setting, they get a very different kind of education. And there are a lot of things that we take for granted that we don't even think about, that they just don't, because it's not necessarily evident. It's not like empirically evident from an ordinary person's perspective. And so there's a lot that you kind of have to explain. But I think as a result of all of that background work, the volume that you guys wound up with is very clear. And a lot of the contributors, I mean, they've been involved in an ongoing conversation. I mean, Wendy, you mentioned that these conversations with the Dalai Lama have been going on for years, right?
Yeah, that's right. And a number of these presenters for this particular meeting have been involved for many decades. So people like Richie Davidson, Matthew Ricard, Tanya Singer has been involved for quite some time. And so a number of people were very familiar with the kind of way that these things unfold, which is great. That really helped, I think, the success of the meeting and hopefully the clarity of the book. And then we did bring in also some new people, though, which is something we always try to do in these dialogues, is to bring in leaders in their fields, whatever discipline they might be within academic study, and then expose them to this conversation. So one of those who was new to this one was Christoph Koch, who is a leading consciousness researcher. And he, is very like reductionist, materialist scientist. And I think he was really changed. He even wrote a little piece of his own after this meeting, because his exposure and just having these conversations, particularly he and Matthew Ricard, got into lots of interesting debates about consciousness. And I think it really, it changed his perspective. And so that's exactly the kind of thing we hope that happens from these events, is people get a different view, expand a little bit.
That's great. Jana, do you have anything to add to that before we move on?
I guess the one other thing I would say from, the editorial perspective, as Wendy said, all of that work that went into it made our jobs easier, which is not to say easy, but easier. But I think, as we mentioned before, because there's material in the book that both Wendy and I know a lot about, and there's not 100% overlap there. And that was part of why we made such good partners, is I think we really brought complementary skills to the book and complementary areas of expertise. But I think what we also tried to do in the end was to sort of use ourselves as a test case for a reader and to try to think, you know, no matter what, everybody who's going to come to this book is going to be an educated non-specialist, because there's no one in the world who's, you know, an expert in every single one of these areas. And so at the end of the day, we sort of tried to be critical readers of our own material to say, okay, when we go through all this work, we make all this effort, can we actually understand this? You know, I can say personally, the material that the book begins with, the material on physics, is fascinating and very difficult. Mm-hmm. And we were a little nervous about leading, opening the book that way, because I think there's some material later on in the book, you know, particularly around some of the secular practices, uses of meditation practices that are, now commonly talked about in really popular media, like, you know, how mindfulness can make you a more productive worker. So there are some ideas there that are a lot more familiar to sort of the common reader. And we sort of started with our hardest material. And so we worked really, really hard to at the end of the day evaluate, okay, we know this is a challenge, and that's going to be the case no matter what, because it just inherently, which is not, of course, to say that the other stuff isn't challenging material as well, but it's not as, doesn't as readily reveal itself as, oh yeah, sure, I can understand quantum physics, no problem. but so I think we really read it to see, okay, do I understand this? I'm not at all suggesting that I understand quantum physics, by the way, but I am suggesting that you know, when we decided that material was done and ready to be included in the book, we felt like, you know, we think that anybody with interest and intention is going to be able to pick this up and make sense of this and still want to keep going. And so we making the material accessible to me was sort of basically my top priority in the book, making it accessible and of course making it interesting. But it doesn't matter how interesting it is if people can't make sense of it, if they don't understand the terminology that's being used, and if they don't understand the connections between, you know, as we've been talking about, it's a huge, the amount of material the book covers is massive. And so we needed to also help people to sort of draw the links between these various areas, so that at the end of the day, they felt like, oh, okay, I see how all of this fits. And I see why this conversation is happening to begin with, and why anybody thought to put all of these people together in a room and to have a conference, and then why Wendy and Jana and Yale decided to turn this into a book. So, because it's not, it's not immediately obvious. And so that was a real focus for us to help readers, you know, follow along. So with us, mm-hmm. And I'm glad that I think our work paid off.
I'll just add one more, or maybe two small points to tack onto that. So yeah, as Jana was saying, the breadth of material in this book is really wide ranging. And so that in part made it a challenge, you know, to fit together into cohesive volume. And I'm glad it came together the way it did. But in a way, that's also, so that came out of the way, of course, we planned the meeting to have that wide of a scope, which was also unusual. In this case, prior dialogues with the Dalai Lama would normally be focused on a specific topic, for example, say physics, or just let's look at consciousness, or, you know, neuroscience or something like that. So in this meeting, and we were planning the conference, we were intentionally really widening the lens to kind of give a broad sense of the whole history of the dialogue between Buddhism and science. So that's why we included so many different areas. And that was in a way also to give an overview for this new audience of Tibetan monastics, so they could get a flavor of all the different areas that this conversation has been evolving in. So that's makes the book really rich, but also in a way, again, a challenge to fit together. And I think the structure that we ended up with really does work. But also I should point out that another nice thing I think that came out is that each chapter can also stand alone. So, you know, if it doesn't actually have to be read in a sequence, we think it fits well that way, but you can kind of pick and choose if there's topics that the reader is particularly interested in. You can jump around and you're not going to lose, you know, the complete meaning of what's going on. So since they came, since each chapter really did come from a presentation and a conversation kind of contained within itself, that's a nice aspect too, because they can also stand alone.
Yeah, that's one of the things that that's another thing that I think is really nice about this book is you can kind of it does tell a cohesive narrative if you read it all the way through, but you can also pick and choose. And you know, if you want to learn about physics, you can, you know, pick it up and just read those chapters and you can kind of get a sense of things. And that's a really nice aspect of the book. So that's something I appreciated.
Yeah, or if you want to speak to physics. Not that you
I mean,
would
but
want
this
to.
this is something that's you know, like that's really hard with any kind of interdisciplinary work in general. Is, you know, whenever you're getting people from very different disciplines together, nobody in the room is going to be a specialist in every single topic that you're talking about. So, you know, all of this kind of preparation and understanding that you have to be able to explain these complex ideas without a lot of jargon and in a way that other people can easily understand, and still be able to get your complex, concrete sort of thesis across in your presentation, that takes a lot of skill. And I think that's something that the contributors to this book, you know, the people who were presenting in these conversations, that's something that they were very good at doing, but it's something that the two of you in editing these conversations did really skillfully. So I'm appreciative of that in reading the book. And I know that wasn't necessarily always easy to do.
Well, thanks. I'm really glad to hear that, that it came across that way.
So I'm curious, you know, I had two questions that I wanted to save for, you know, kind of towards the end of the interview, but Wendy, you said, you know, the point of these conversations is not necessarily to change neuroscience or Buddhism. And my questions were, you know, how has neuroscience changed as a result of these conversations and how has Buddhism changed as a result of these conversations? So I'm going to revise those questions. And I'm just curious, you know, from both of your perspectives, what do you think that neuroscientists or neuroscience as a field has learned as a result of conversations like these?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of areas where neuroscience has advanced because of these conversations and because of now a line of inquiry into contemplative practice like meditation, for example. So that's another thing that's, of course, come out of these conversations and this interchange. One, I think, is the way the emphasis or kind of a renewed value on subjective experience and first person inquiry, which is obviously really strong in the Buddhist contemplative traditions, a way of investigating one's own experience internally. And science, you know, traditionally would just bring this third person or objective view from the outside and kind of like, let's look at someone's brain to try to understand what's going on. But of course, you also really, when you're studying mind or someone's experience, you need some subjective aspects to bring that in. And to do that really rigorously is where contemplative practices are so beautiful as a they can dovetail with science because they do have a kind of rigor and reliability and consistency and building of skill sets. So studying that and bringing in that voice of the subjective side into scientific inquiry is something that I think this conversation has really enriched cognitive science and neuroscience. And it's still unfolding, you know, the best ways to do that. It's not always immediately clear how that can be done. But I think things are moving forward in terms of methodologies where participants can provide input on their own experience, and scientists can rely more on that than they used to. I think for a long time in psychology, there was a hesitance to rely on anyone's reports of their own experience, because of course we do know that they are not always reliable, but that's part of why working with people who are trained in meditation, because you can gain a more and more rigorous and nuanced understanding of your own experience that can really help in the study of the mind and the brain. I think the other thing that's going on in neuroscience, which is really exciting, and I think that the study of these practices has really, this isn't happening only because of that, but this is really advancing it in large part, is this whole idea of neuroplasticity and the ability of the brain to change through practice and experience. And in the last 15, 20 years, I think there's been a total revolution in psychology and neuroscience about the capacity of the human mind and the human brain to change itself, and just how possible that is over the lifespan. For many, many decades, it was thought that after adolescence or in your early 20s, you know, you were wired up the way you were going to be, and your personality was pretty fixed, and you know, you are who you are, and that's kind of it, and no need to bother trying to change. And now we know that that concept has really completely been thrown out the window now, and a lot of evidence just keeps coming out from these brain studies, of particularly of meditation practice and mental training, like contemplative practices, of just how quickly the brain can be rewired and experience can be changed accordingly. And I mean, within a 1 day intervention shows consistent effects on these kinds of things. So, and this is, you know, in people well into adulthood. So I think that's a really exciting development that's happening in neuroscience, and the exchange with Buddhism and Buddhist practices has had a large part to do with that.
Yeah. Jana, is there anything you have noticed as a result of these conversations, or anything you want to add to this?
I think that really the question that we're talking about here, and we actually included in some of the, I think it might even be in the jacket copy of the book, of sort of what can science do for a monk and what can a monk do for science? I think it's actually a really fascinating and really challenging question. I think particularly coming from the Western world, I feel like my idea for so long was, well, either you believe in religion or you believe in science, and sort of ne'er the two shall meet. And we have almost no models for any kind of personal practice or belief system that could successfully integrate those two things. And while I should say that, and as we talk about, and as His Holiness talks a lot about, that the material in the book that we're talking about here is Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy, and that there's a whole lot to Buddhist religion that's really not addressed in this book unintentionally. So the model to say, well, actually, these two systems don't have to agree entirely for us to be informed by them, for us to be excited by them, and for us to find, it's not to say, well, I'm a monk and I believe completely in my tradition, and then I got exposed to science and now I decided that actually all this other stuff I've learned isn't true, and so now I'm going to go, you know, I don't know, right, live a secular life or become a scientist or something. That's not it at all. It's actually, I think there's a real model in the lack of fear that's expressed in this, to say, you know, this is it's okay if sometimes we don't agree. It's okay if I might be proved wrong, or if I might prove you wrong. But this is an ongoing conversation that can be playful and informative and creative, and that doesn't necessarily have to result in a change in practice or a change in discipline, but in a change in orientation toward one's own practice. So, you know, His Holiness has said that his exposure to materials around research showing how meditative practice affects the brain has really increased his conviction to practice. And one of the contributors in the book says that she really thinks of science as an ethical practice. And so I really like that idea that the takeaway of these, one of the takeaways of these conversations is not to turn Buddhists into scientists and scientists into Buddhists, but that it actually makes more engaged scientists and more engaged Buddhists in whatever way that means. I actually think that's really beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, that's really amazing. And I mean, and we see with, and you guys mentioned this in the book, but with the Dalai Lama's encouragement of introducing the study of Western science into some Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. And, you know, the intention, like you said, Jana, is not to turn these monks into scientists, but to give them other tools to think about the world. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to abandon their Buddhist beliefs, the same way that Buddhism doesn't necessarily have to make scientists abandon their scientific processes. So that's, I think these conversations are really rich and really productive for that reason. I want to thank you guys for taking the time to talk with me today. You know, we're coming up on an hour here, so I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I have one last question for each of you before we wrap up. And, Jana, maybe we can start with you. What's next for you, or what are you working on now? What are you involved in right now in terms of, you know, the work that you're doing?
That's a great question. I don't have another specific book project lined up, although I'm really excited to find one in the future. Right now, I think I'm really just enjoying basking in the fact that this book is done and that it's out there in the world, and finding some readers and finding some success. It was such a long journey, such an amazing learning experience, and really for me brought together so many different parts of my life into one sort of a just really amazing project. So I have thought a lot about and been asked a lot kind of what's next. And I think right now I'm really focused on just enjoying this part of the process after so many stages of feeling like, wow, is this thing ever actually going to be done? And it is, and it's so wonderful. And I'm so proud of that. And so part of what I'm doing now is just really appreciating that. In a different vein, I'm focusing now. I'm participating in a women's leadership institute locally, and I think trying to become as engaged as I can in my professional life. I'm also doing some other, as I mentioned earlier, some academic administration, and much in the model of, I think, the people represented in this book, trying to not look at these things as somehow separate but complementary. And if I can be engaged in my professional practice across my life, then hallelujah. So that's what I'm doing.
Well, and that's great. And this, I think the yes, you should enjoy basking in the glow of this book, because I know that it was a long time in the making for both of you. And I also just, because you mentioned this women's leadership program that you're involved in, I'm so thrilled that two talented and intelligent women were involved in the creation of this book when it deals with neuroscience and Buddhist philosophy, which are two fields that historically have been very heavily dominated by men. And just given the fact that there were so many monks in the room present when these conversations were happening, there were definitely a lot of women's voices that maybe weren't present in the conversation. So I'm just glad that both of you were involved in working on this. So Wendy, what about you? What's next for you? What are you working on now?
I continue to work with the Mind and Life Institute. I serve as the science director there. So since the time of this conference, my work has shifted from planning and helping with the dialogues. Really more now I'm focusing on the grant funding, so the research funding that we provide to scientists and scholars to do this kind of work in contemplative science and push the field forward, which is really exciting for me. And the other thing that's on the horizon for me is I'm going to start teaching at University of Virginia in the spring semester, starting in January. And I'll be doing a course on kind of an intro to contemplative science. So this book has served as a great resource and learning experience and scaffolding for me as I'm thinking about ways to convey and talk about this field kind of writ large and all that goes into it and modes of inquiry and all that kind of stuff. So I'm excited to bring that now to students at UVA this spring. So yeah, good things ahead.
That's great. That sounds really exciting. Are you going to be using this book as a kind of textbook for that course?
I'm not planning to work through it systematically as a textbook, although that could be a fun course to plan, but I probably will use pieces of it, maybe the introduction and a couple of excerpts from chapters to give examples of some of these areas of research. So That's another great, nice bonus from having worked on the book.
Well, that's great. Well, Jana, Wendy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. And, good luck with things in the future.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Really fun. Thanks for having us.
All right. That was Wendy Hassenkamp and Jana White, co-editors of The Monastery and the Microscope, Conversations with the Dalai Lama on Mind, Mindfulness, and the Nature of Reality, published by Yale University Press in 2017. You can find out about more new books in Buddhist studies and other academic fields by visiting newbooksnetwork.com or by searching for New Books Network wherever you get your podcasts.